Hello, this is Clint Locklear with Trapping Radio. I'm up at the NTA with John Daniels, and we're going to be, first off, before we get started, let's talk a little bit about the NTA.
Okay.
Because you thought that I was, well, no, you didn't, but some guys thought that what I said in the last week or so, that it was negative NTA, and I want everybody to know that's not the case. I was just being Clint, talking about stuff.
Okay, sure.
So, the gun thing. We've talked about that, but you know what you told me though was pretty interesting. You said that no one else bid for this.
That's correct.
So yeah. There wasn't an option. It was either no NTA or in a communist state.
Right.
Okay. So
well, you're sort of right.
Well, if it's not Second Amendment friendly, I don't know what else to call it. So. Quasi-communist. Are you more comfortable with that?
That'll work.
Okay. And the thing about the air conditioning, I guess I'm just getting old and it'd be nice. So that's all I was saying about that. And like we talked about the income thing, and there wasn't any malice with that at all. It was just, I just foresee there has to be a way to generate money. So when we have to do these lawsuits, like we'll probably talk about in a minute, It's not just based on donations. It can be, you know, different things like that. So are we feel the love now, so there's no...
Sure, no problem.
No problems, okay. The main reason I wanted to have you on is because with the new laws in Tennessee, I'm getting emails. I know you're getting emails. When I talked to you the first time and you talked about, you know, they're going off the BMPs finally, it's about time that... Like when I was looking at the BMPs, you know, I wasn't sure what to say because from my understanding of the BMPs on coyotes, it was a Canadian double laminated Canadian modified trap.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure that's exactly what our laws are. So it's before I put my foot in my mouth about what the laws are, I was going to have you explain so everybody would know.
Well, you know, basically, as you know, Tennessee's trapping regulations are pretty broad spectrum and kind of cover all species within their guidelines, with those maximum sizes 9 1/4, whatever it is, outside jaw dimensions, and everything else is kind of all inclusive underneath that. Under the old regulations, if you were on top of the ground, it had
hold,
to be
hold up 9 1/2 inch jaw,
9 1/4, I believe, maybe outside dimensions.
For a foothold trap?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Right.
I didn't even know that. I thought they were still like 7 1/2.
You know, you may be right on that.
That's an inch bigger than the TS-85.
Right.
I mean, it could be.
Right. 7 1/4, I believe, is what it is.
Okay. Maybe. So, like, you could still use a number 5 Bridger in the MB-750s.
Right. MB-750 is kind of a gray area. It's kind of depending on where you measure it at, and who that person is measuring it. And in my opinion, if we're trying to stay legal and we're trying to keep ourselves in line, we would have to be really careful on the use of that 750.
So what about those 7 1/2 inch jaw spread TS-85s?
If whatever that
don't go there, dude. They're not 7 1/2. In case you didn't know, I was just making a bad joke. Okay, so I'm sorry to interrupt, but you threw me off on the 9 1/2. I was like, good grief, what trap is 9 1/2 inches that you can buy?
I was thinking about my shoe size.
Okay, that'll work. So they're all inclusive.
Right. So basically what we did is, well, let me go back and give you a little history on it, of how this all got started. A few years ago, our vice president he's a water trapper, Clarence Dyes, and he was out on the river trying to stay legal and checking his traps in pretty dangerous waters because of the wind conditions and whitecaps and what have you, and his boat was getting swamped, and he started thinking that, you know, it would be nice on lethal sets to have a 72-hour check on lethal sets.
Absolutely.
So he called me up, asked me what I thought about it, and I asked him if he would mind doing a little research on neighboring states. And Jim Spencer was very helpful with that and gave us a lot of information. He was instrumental on getting that done in Arkansas. And basically, we wanted to make sure that people had not had any issues when they went to that 72-hour check as far as public relations-wise issues. So, because bottom line is, we always want to keep that in the back of our mind, because that's what keeps this trapping is, you know, like it or not, especially when you're governed by legislation, as we were in Tennessee, public perception is extremely important.
Because, like, our state's not like some states. Politicians make the rules. It's not the TWRA.
They did.
Right?
They did.
They did. They,
and so as we checked into that, after we found that out, we're fortunate enough that the assistant to the director of the TWRA is also one of Clarence's neighbors. And they've become friends over the years. And he asked him how we should go about this situation. And he felt like, to start with, that the possibilities of getting it done simply were fairly easy. And then the more we checked into it, it would fall under legislation as well. So the first thing we had to do is look at and the possibility of changing that. Now, we've talked about that, discussed that for many years, what was the right thing to do there. I went over to Clarence's house, and we had a meeting with Chris, and we discussed those things. And you know, one of the main things that kept coming up is, you know, with the exception of trapping, you know, the professionals of the TWRA, they handle those things. They handle hunting, they handle fishing, they handle boating. That's what they're trained to do. That's what they're educated to do. It just didn't really make sense that trapping be under legislation when all other wildlife forms of wildlife management were handled by the TWRA. And part of Chris's job is that Chris was an attorney for 5 years prior to working for the TWRA. And part of Chris's job with the TWRA is cleaning up ancient and outdated regulations and things like that. So we discussed that, and we were able to get Senator Mike Bell to sponsor the bill, and House Representative Ron Lawler co-sponsored the bill, and it was presented in the House, and basically explained it was in the name of good housekeeping that we change that and bring trapping under the rule of TWRA the same as the other things. And we didn't we had one senator out of Knoxville that was kind of opposed to it, but it passed. And from there we went to
is that who you had me go visit with a bat? Is that who that was?
So we went from there. Clint's trying to get me in trouble. We went from there, and we proposed the changes we needed. But in the middle of that meeting that we were talking about that, we were talking about other outdated things. And one of those outdated things, while padded jaw traps enabled us to trap in Tennessee, because as you know, when I started trapping, and probably you too, you had to be 12 inches inside a hole or den to trap in Tennessee. And that padded jaw trap got that back for us. And with improved trapping methods, improved traps and techniques, there were as efficient or better ways available to us now other than a padded jaw trap that made it as humane or more humane in many cases to use other traps. And you know, we had that conversation, we talked about it, and I explained to Chris about the BMP process and how it worked. And Chris is a very intelligent guy, and he understood it really well and really got the concept, and helped us get things the way we needed to get it done. And we wrote up some wording and provided it to him to take to the officials of TWRA. And this past few months, we were able to get that changed by proclamation.
Now, for y'all guys that don't know, TWRA is Tennessee Wildlife Resources Association. It's kind of our version of everybody else's DNR. So when somebody's saying that, you know what that means. So what specifically, like I've already got a question, what is a lethal set?
A lethal set is any set that basically euthanizes the animal. So that when you check that trap, you're expecting to find an expired animal. The animal's not going to be alive in that trap most of the time. Mm-hmm. As we know, anything can malfunction or what have you, and that doesn't mean that's a 100% guarantee. But, all body grip type traps, drowning sets on slide wires, that type of thing, are considered lethal sets.
Is it specific about that in there? I mean, the reason I'm asking is if I know someone's going to put this tangle stake up in a 3-inch creek and say that it's lethal. I mean, is it specific so there's no gray area, or is it gray area on purpose?
There's no gray area on purpose.
Okay.
That comes down the pike, there's always someone that's going to interpret something to their benefit. So with that being said, is can someone find a gray area? I'm sure they can.
Okay. But it doesn't say body grips or drowning sets.
It does say body gripping traps. And it gives examples and drowning sets.
Okay.
In there.
That'll work. So, and the biggest one is on the traps itself.
Right. And the size restrictions and all of that stayed the same as it was. Basically, what was done, the regulations that govern padded jaw traps as far as size and that type of thing, the laminated traps, the offset jaw traps, and the cast jaws like the MBs, they were included in that. So basically any trap that fit the description of the padded jaw trap that is now laminated or laminated offset, wide cast jaw, or double jaw that meets that minimum of 1/4 inch thickness on the jaw thickness will qualify.
Okay. So there's not, so offset's not necessary. The main thing is that 1/4 inch thickness.
That's the key thing. The one trap there that's a little different there is that double jawed trap, which under the BMP studies proved to be the most humane trap for coon.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where that, you know, that was added in there.
But if it's set in water, it doesn't matter, correct?
No, right.
So all the water stuff's still the same?
Water stuff's still the same.
Okay, so the easiest way for someone to make sure they're legal, so there's no question, is just to weld 1/4 inch stock for lamination, because that's 1/4 inch.
Quarter inch, or if you 1/8 inch, because your jaw thickness is already pretty much 1/8 inch. So you could, you know, if you wanted to get down to the brass tacks and get to the minimum, you could do, as long as you have, it doesn't matter, as long as you have from top to bottom of that jaw, 1/4 inch.
Okay, so it's just the thick, it's not the offset, it's not the other stuff with the Canadian modified about the number of swivels, the base plate, the fork hole, none of that matters. It's just the thickness.
Right.
That's pretty simple to keep up
with. It is.
Yeah.
It is.
Y'all did a good job on that. This lets you know when this is over with, you're getting a kiss, but I don't want to do that on the radio show. So, that's...
Can I take a rain check on that?
No. Not when you get me off rubber jaw traps. No, that deserves a big kiss. So, but we do... That's pretty cool, man. I mean, that's like a win.
Yeah. I'm very proud of it. Clarence and I have worked on this for about 1.5 years, and we're both termed out as officers. You can only serve per our bylaws two-year terms, and so we're going out leaving a good legacy behind. We got those two changes recently. We also were very instrumental in the out-of-state trap license reduction.
What'd that go down to?
They went down to 250. They were cut them in half.
Yeah.
Then we worked on the trap tag a few years back, so that you only have to have your TWRA number on the tag instead of your name.
I had so many of those made, I'm still using the, just because since I sell trap tags, you think I could go ahead and do that, but I just never have.
You know, that one, and that's what amazed me about this last one, I introduced that to the commission 7 years before it was adopted.
What was the reasoning for wanting to have that information there?
Well, the whole idea behind that was, and the example that I used, my name is John Daniel. I've got two cousins that live in the near proximity of me that also are John Daniel. And I didn't want my reputation tarnished if another John Daniel, somebody read that, and I may be a little better known than some of the other ones, and automatically when they see that trap tag with that on there, or suppose I accidentally did have a non-target catch and the person was hostile about it, if he has my name, he can come to me. But if all he has is my TWRA number, he has to go to the proper authorities, and it's handled the way it's supposed to be handled.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it was a way to eliminate problems.
To me, that's genius, because it's kind of like, I've talked to some guys, I've actually talked to some game wardens. I was going to go to another state one time, and they told me that the game warden said, let me run with you when you set the traps. And it made me very nervous. He said, because as soon as you set those traps, your traps will be set illegally somewhere, and we will get a phone call. Mm-hmm. They knew who it was that was doing it. They knew that was going to happen. And they said, especially with your name on there, it's going to happen. We're going to know it. But with the number, someone wouldn't know
right
who anybody was
right
unless you gave that number out for some reason.
Right. And I've actually heard stories of just that thing happening several different times. You know, basically somebody being set up.
Yeah.
By an anti or, something along those lines.
Well, if you were diabolical, and see, like, my dad lives pretty close to you over there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So if I was like, I want to start running from my house to my dad's house, and I think John's getting too coon that I could have got wherever you're trapping at.
Sure.
And I get mad, I could get those made and put them on the courthouse lawn with a house cat in it or something.
Sure.
Or anything. I mean, sure. It's never made sense to me to have it done the way that it's done.
Right.
So, that's pretty cool. I wish more, because the first time I dealt with that was in New Mexico, because it was very weird, because they were like, here's your number, you need to have trap tags with these numbers. I'm like, what in the world is that? And they basically, what they said was sometimes the antis get really rowdy, and they'll find your trap, and then they'll start harassing you, death threats and threaten to burn your house down. And he said, most of them aren't credible, but you don't know, and there's no reason to give them that power. And I was like, that's pretty slick.
Right.
Because I get enough death threats as it is from all the stuff I'm doing.
We've come a long ways with our relationship with the TWRA. We've been working with them more and more every year on different things. Our Hiawassee Trapper Training Camp, it's going into its 13th year now. We've been certifying kids up there under the TWRA Trapper Education Program now for about the last 12 years of it, I think, now 10, 11 years of it. We just started a new camp that we partnered with them on over at Buffalo River Wildlife Refuge over in West Tennessee. We had that over there this past February, and I've been helping. I've been an instructor at their bow class the last few years. I'm proud of the relationship that we're building with them. And I tell you, when you come to these national conventions, sit in these board meetings like I do, and not everybody is fortunate enough to have a good relationship with their DNR.
That's true.
And we're pretty lucky with what we've got. And our regulations in Tennessee are not too bad.
Mm-mm.
And I tell you, those guys have done an excellent job reintroducing and managing wildlife in our state.
Well, just from all the states I've been, John, with the laws, because we still have snares, not some type of crazy, we got to do something special. The two states that everybody wants to go to just to have fun trapping is Louisiana or Mississippi, because it's a 24-hour check. Mississippi, you got to be 100 foot off a maintained road. Besides that, it's whatever you want to do.
Right.
Really, our laws are about like that. Mm-hmm. If you just use common sense, you can do anything you want in our state except put body grips on dry ground.
Right. And that's just it. We have some people that use common sense that write our regulations, and
mm-hmm.
and that's good. I'm very thankful for that. We've got a commission that truly cares and listens to you. If you want to go to one of their commission meetings and talk to them, I guarantee you'll be treated with respect, and they'll listen to you. Things don't always happen fast, you know. But
it's government. That's just part of it.
Yeah, but we've truly got a good working relationship with them, and they're a great outfit. Really proud of what our state does.
What advice would you have for if you think you have any? I mean, what would you, if the state's not having good luck with their commission, what would your advice be to, I mean, how did we, because I've never felt like TWRA was adversarial towards us as trappers at all. I've never got that feeling.
You know, and you're right, they're not. And in most cases, that's not really the issue. Now, I'm not saying that's not always the issue in different states, but in most cases, that's probably not the issue. Trapping is probably the most misunderstood and the misinformed of all. So, and my suggestion would be to make as good a connection as possible. You know, work with them if they have an event going on that you can lend a hand and build that relationship where you guys can talk on a one-on-one level. So that you're familiar with each other and they understand what you stand for and what you represent. It's going to make it easier in the long run. Education is the key to everything. Mm-hmm. You know, if you can't have good education and good information out there, it's hard for anybody to relate, especially if they've never done it and they've never experienced it.
Well, let's talk to a gentleman here. I'm not going to mention the state, but they're getting ready to start working with their DNR, and He was kind of talking, they want to learn how to trap, and he's like half worried. They're the only want to learn to try to find someone's trap instead of actually learn about the trap. Mm-hmm. And what I've learned with most game wardens, I mean, unless they're just environmental, you know, extremists when they get there, when they actually learn about trapping, the respect of that really grows really quick.
You know, and I'm glad you brought that up, Clint. I mentioned a minute ago our new trapper training class over at Buffalo River Refuge. Trapping class over there was a week long. The first half of that week, we taught TWRA officers, new officers, about trapping. And the last half of it, we opened it up to the general public. Most of those officers didn't have a clue about trapping. You know, and kind of in response to educating them on how to find something, you know what, that's not a bad thing. I don't know how many times in my presentations I've said we're one catch away from losing our trapping rights. It only takes one wrong catch of the one wrong senator's daughter's dog.
We almost lost our conibears over.
Exactly. You know, it only takes that one wrong person with the right amount of influence, and it's gone for us. So I say I'm glad that they learned how to find those illegal sets. I'm glad that they know how to identify those and get them out of the way before they become that one set that loses it for us.
I can see that, yeah. Yeah, I mean, to me, the game wardens that, like where I'm at in Marion County and Sequatchie, a lot of those guys trap now.
Yeah.
You know, sure. And it started when I started working for Marion County, and they had no idea what it was I was doing. And they would, you know, take me places and they would see what I was doing. What amazed them the most was the knowledge that you had to have to be a trapper. Because at first it seemed like they thought you would just like put a peanut butter and jelly sandwich down in front of something and all the animals would run from the next county over to get into it. And they would see you doing stuff and they're like, why are you doing that? And you know, you start getting in the weeds with them and you know, their brains just like, I thought y'all were like dumb, hillbilly, backwards, you know, don't want to be in modern society people. And I'm a biology major and I didn't know that. You know, that's where the respect, at least what I saw.
Sure. You know, and you're spot on, and I've experienced that several different times. You know, they're biology majors, but in many ways a trapper is a biologist himself. Mm-hmm. You know, he has to know animal behavior, animal habits. You know, that it's very important. And you know, unless you're a specialist that only traps coyote or only traps beaver or only traps whatever, you know, you have to be versed in several different species. So, you know, where a deer hunter has to understand a deer's habits or a turkey hunter understands a turkey habits, a trapper has to understand a lot of different things and have a lot of education. And, you know, when you're looking at that and looking at the fact that you want to start off by respecting the animal and making sure that your catch is treated the way it should be treated, and after you harvest that animal, give it the respect, do it to put that fur up the right way, and so they can be marketed and be utilized as a useful product. There's a lot that goes into to being a trapper, and a trapper is one of the true conservationists in our country.
Absolutely. I mean, because, you know, one thing that I've had some people, because I do a lot of the hippie farming, so I'm around a lot of hippies. They know nothing about that. You know, they always say the best culture was hunter-gatherer. When they meet one, it scares them to death. You know, I mean, the idea that something's still walking around that still hunts, fishes, or traps and eats anything, it just freaks them out. But they think that we're out to kill every, like we get our jollies off on just trying to kill every single thing that's around us. And then you start talking about, well, that's the dumbest thing in the world, because, you know, I guarantee you every trapper has done something. Like when I first came back from Alaska, for 2 years I trapped one beaver flow and it was like heaven for me. I didn't have a lot of property to trap on. I trapped that too hard. That went away. There's nothing there now. I mean, I learned a big lesson. You abuse this, it's gone. So you don't go that far.
You know, and I remember when I was a kid starting to trap. We have an abundance of beaver now, but I remember when I saw my first beaver dam and my first beaver. You know, there weren't any beaver in the area, really. I remember when I knew old men when I was a kid, and I say old men, they were probably my age.
Right.
they seemed like old men to me, mm-hmm. who had deer hunted all their life and had never killed a deer. And now it's almost like going to the supermarket and going grocery shopping.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, management is so important in that. You know, when a trapper don't want to eliminate a species. He wants to manage that species. He wants to keep their populations in check, keep them healthy, and harvest access.
I mean, I get nervous in our valley when otter prices get high, because we only have one waterway.
Right.
And there's about six people that trap otter, and no one knows how many everybody else is catching. So normally in my own valley, I pretty much stay away from otter just because I don't know. You know, and a non-trapper would have a hard time understanding that.
Right.
Because I don't know if there can't be that many in the one valley with one river, even though they're maybe 40 miles apart where they get caught.
Right. Well, you know, and the otter is one of those things that is such a short time ago that we didn't have any. Mm-hmm. That's one to really remember, that, you know, you do have to manage them and you do have to think that way. You know, you have to think that way. You know, you don't take more than can recover.
Well, all in beaver I took in Marion County, it just sure didn't make no difference on them. I never did.
At one time it did, because back in the day, something got rid of them.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as many as I was catching, though, it was, it never got below, I think, 600, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, you think of 600 beaver, that's a lot of beaver coming out of one county.
Right.
And there was years way more than that, and it never did touch.
Right.
They're more resilient than we think, but
right.
you still have to manage it. So what's going on with the NTA? I mean, as far as what can y'all brag about to us?
You know, the NTA has made big strides in the last 5 or 6 years to really be that front runner in defense for trapping. We're extremely fortunate that our legal counsel is a trapper himself. And when I say he's a trapper himself, I don't mean he goes out in his spare time on the weekend and he catches something for 2 or 3 days and then he's done for the year. Gary Lestico is a true outdoorsman. He lives it, he breathes it, and he eats it. And when it's season, he's out there doing it. And he understands it from front to back, and it's a passion to him to make sure that we keep it and protect it. And he has been such a huge asset to us. We're involved in over seven lawsuits right now. The antis are basically abusing the Endangered Species Act for their advantage. And we're fortunate that we have a guy like Gary on our team that can go out there and do it.
One thing about him, do you know what Chip said to him? Chip don't know I'm going to say this, but when Chip interviewed him, what he texted me after that, and he said, this dude is a warrior. for
trapping. I guarantee you.
Yeah, I mean, he was like, that's a strong statement. You know, yeah. I was like, that's cool. Is it the same guy when I was NTA director?
No, I think maybe Jim Lister or Gary Lassoff may have been the attorney then.
Yeah, okay.
But have you ever met Gary in person?
I don't think I have.
If you ever have the opportunity to sit down and talk to him, he's truly a down-to-earth guy. And when you start talking to him about these things, the determination that you see in his eyes is all you need to understand exactly what Chip just said. I mean, it's totally there.
Mm-hmm.
He would fight to the death for trapping.
That's awesome.
Yeah, we're very fortunate there.
Okay, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I just had to say, because, I mean, that impressed me more than anything else when Chip said that.
Right, right. And you're right. And you made me lose my train of thought, so I don't even know where I was at.
You were talking about it abusing. Are you talking... See, the way I understand that, if I get that right, if I wanted to sue over a trapping issue, the government would have to pay for the legal fees, the government would have to pay for the lawyers, so it wouldn't cost me any money to be a troublemaker.
No, not that's not necessarily true,
okay.
And that depends on what court, and there's different things there, and I don't want to get into those type of legalities because I'm not Gary.
Right, okay, okay.
Basically what they're doing is, you know, they're basically taking, and I'll use a lynx as a good example of it. The lynx is not an endangered species. There may be a very few lynx in a certain state,
mm-hmm.
But what you have to think about there, you've got a border. The name is Canadian lynx, and the name is Canadian lynx for a reason, you
mm-hmm.
know. what does that kind of tell you there? So when you get south of Canada, it stands to reason the further from Canada you get, the fewer and fewer lynx you're going to have. So basically under the Endangered Species Act, the way it's written up now, you can, on a state-by-state basis, that animal could be endangered within that state, the way it is written up. And they take advantage of that, and if maybe there's not a lynx season in that state, but an incidental is taken here and there, and what they do, they sue the state and tell the state that they're allowing take of an endangered species within that state, and they sue the state. So the state has to defend their position on that. So what happens in that situation, it goes back to kind of what we were talking about a little while ago. Not all DNRs are funded the same or governed the same,
mm-hmm.
So it's that's going to have a bearing on things and their funding and what have you. So when that takes into consideration when they're defending a case like that. So what might happen there, while they may not agree with the plaintiff in that case, what may happen, they may be willing to compromise some more than a trapper or the trapper's best interest, because they're looking at the big picture of their DNR and what it would take to protect their DNR, mm-hmm. and keep it as efficient as possible. So what we do on the NTA, we file as the interveners in that case, and we stand in there to make sure when those negotiations happen and that litigation happens that our voice is heard on what's best for the trappers. A good example, I was listening to some conversation.
Has anybody ever said the Canadian lynx is a Canadian lynx for a reason? I mean,
I don't know.
To me, that should like end the case.
Well, you know, you would think, you know.
I know two people in Tennessee that raise hedgehogs.
Mm-hmm.
So between the two, they've got about 8 hedgehogs a year.
Right.
So they're pretty close to extinct in Tennessee, but they're thriving in Europe.
Right.
They can't get rid of them.
Right.
So, I mean, that's crazy to me that's the basis.
Right. Well, but what they base it on is indigenous to an area. If their home range, when 1776 rolled around, if their home range was in a certain area, they were indigenous to that area, and that's what they base it on more so than the name. You know, there's a lot of things like that in that recovering process. You know, one thing that comes to mind in Tennessee was the attempt to reintroduce Fisher,
mm-hmm.
You know, a few years back into their home range. And that's kind of what they use there. And a lot of that is just a way for the antis to shut trapping down. that wasn't what the Endangered Species Act was intended to do.
Right.
It was intended to truly protect and reestablish endangered species. Now, if you look at and that lynx situation, the incidental take permit that was issued in Maine a few years back, it was three lynx in I think 10 years or 15 years, don't quote me on that exact number. Well, two were caught in the first 2 years. And the definition of take is not what you and I would think. If your ink pen's laying there on that table and pick that up and I take that out with me, I've taken your ink pen.
Mm-hmm.
That's take. Well, and the Endangered Species Act, if a lynx is out there in the woods, he's doing things that lynx do, and he turns around and sees me and runs away, he doesn't come back to that area, I've taken that lynx. So that definition.
Wow.
Yeah. Isn't that something, you know, that common sense just doesn't have a play in many things.
Wow. So it's not even that you trapped and turned it loose. It's just if they think that it doesn't come back.
Right. That definition of take can really, really be an issue. Now, that's where I don't understand why more sportsmen of all types, hikers, don't get more involved in these types of cases. There are so many types of endangered plants and different things like that that's out there, that if somebody wanted to abuse the Endangered Species Act, you couldn't walk across the ground, let alone go in there and go fishing or hunting or trapping or biking or mm-hmm. whatever the case may be. And the precedent that's set in those cases is potentially dangerous for any of those things. I don't understand.
Well, I mean, I was just doing, before this, I was interviewing Terry Manley, and he buys ginseng. And, you know, that's on the Floral Endangered Act.
Right.
Which to me means at any time that could be shut off just for the simple fact of too many people walking in the woods.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's to me that's insane.
Yeah, it is. It, I mean, it truly is. You know, a plant or an insect. There's so many things that fall under that. You know, if you step in the wrong place and you damage or take mm-hmm. one of those species, you know, it could shut that whole area down. Mm-hmm. And you know. The Endangered Species Act was a good thing. You know, when our country was young, we raped and abused this country.
Absolutely.
You know, and as we learned, that's why we had things like the Endangered Species Act. But like anything else, like you and I were talking about gray areas and people taking advantage of those, unfortunately, that's one of those things that that people want to try to twist and use for their own personal gain, not for what mm-hmm. it was intended for. It's a shame it's that way. And, you know, quite honestly, in many cases, I feel like it's a monetary issue that, you know, people figured out, certain organizations figured out that, you know, they can twist and misinterpret and use to their advantage to basically line their pockets by, you know, presenting those types of cases out there. Exactly. Yeah, it is.
I mean, I heard a rumor from several people, I think it's true, to show the lunacy of that. There were some guys up above Knoxville that were running the chicken fights.
Mm-hmm.
And the feds found out about it. They come in, they arrest a bunch of people. They take the chickens and instantly kill them because they could get killed in the fight. They took the chickens because they were protecting them to kill them because they didn't know what to do with them, or roosters, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that was a good thing. And when you logically look at that, that's like, that makes no sense whatsoever. I mean, you killed the animal that you're trying to protect, so it really wasn't about the animal. There's no way that it was. You know, I'm not into rooster fighting at all, but that story, I'll never forget that, because I was like, that's the craziest. It's like you go rescue a bunch of fighting dogs and you shoot them in the parking lot to, you know,
instead of rehabbing them.
Yeah. I mean, you know, something with the money. That's what I don't. Not to make this about PETA, but the money they raise, they could buy property and have like pet Edens where they get to run around and do their thing and die of old age, totally happiness. They have that kind of money and capacity to do that, but they never do.
Yep. Yeah, it would be interesting to, you know, look at the millions of dollars that's raised in the name of humanity, that or humane, and how much of that percentage is actually spent on the goal that it's set there for. I don't know what that number would be, but I bet it would be pretty small.
Well, I mean, on the rant I was doing about the begging thing, you know, last year it was $1.74 trillion that was raised by 501c3s.
Mm-hmm.
The expense to run those 1.5 million 501c3s was $1.68 trillion.
Mm-hmm.
So they raised $174 trillion and they spent $168. So there's less than, I don't even know how to figure that up because those zeros are so big, but it's not much.
Right.
I mean, percentage wise.
Right. And understandably, you have to have, there's going to be operating costs in anything.
Oh, sure.
But, you know, I don't know if that's, I'd hate to have to run my business that way.
You dang Skippy. You better have three or four of them to do that. So what other lawsuits are the NTAs helping us out with?
We're involved in Montana, Idaho, Oregon.
Over the wolves.
Right. Minnesota. And still in Maine.
Has there been any of these lawsuits
wolves,
to do with Wolverine?
Lynx, the Wolverine case, we're not involved in that case. We may be at some point in time, but we're not at this time. That is a case of interest just because it's similar to those other cases. And again, you've got precedent you have to look at.
What are they trying to do with the Wolverine? I mean, because people...
It's basically
kind of like the lynx.
Kind of, you know, they're basically saying that their home range is being disturbed and their habitat, you know, and.
But it's not a trapping issue. It's more of a land use issue.
More of that, yes.
Okay. And the wolf thing, does that seem to be getting straightened out at all?
The wolf issue is getting better. I think that we're going to be okay in the wolf issue as time goes on. It's like anything that it's going to have its growing pains and its problems and issues. But I think as time goes on and data shows that there needs to be better management practices to handle them, and you start looking at calf kills, wildlife kills, and things like that, we already know we have to manage populations no matter what those populations are. It's our responsibility to do it because we disturbed their habitat a long time ago.
That's right.
We condensed everything into smaller areas, and you know, it's our responsibility to manage it. Now, does that mean manage one species and let the other one run rampant? No, it doesn't. It means you've got to manage all those species.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, in the plant world, we get into that all the time. Would someone tell me, like, autumn olives? A lot of people hate autumn olives in Tennessee. You know, they planted them years ago for wildlife, and the birds spread them. And I grow them on my farm because they give nitrogen to my other fruit trees. And other farmers have bitched at me about that and said they're not native. And I'm like, well, they're native to the world. And when you're talking about native, when exactly are you talking about? Like, when the chestnut was the overstory tree and everything else was understory? Because if that's the case, nothing's native. Is it before all the roads and all the houses and, you know, all the clear cuts? And what exactly are you referring to as native? And no one ever has a definition of what a native is. Because in order to get it back the way that it was in 1600s, we all got to go somewhere.
You'd
have to give it all back.
Right.
Because the house is in the way of the buffalo or whatever, you know.
Right.
I mean, yeah. So what else is the NTA doing?
Well, we're here this week.
That's true.
taking care of business and putting on a convention for our members. And in my mind, that's a great thing. I remember when I was a kid and dreaming about trapping and reading the trapping books. I grew up in a less than well-off family and never dreamed I would even be able to travel to one of these things at the time. And you know, for me, I'm like a kid in a candy shop to this day. I'm 53 years old, but I still get stars in my eyes when I walk down those aisles and see those people. It's especially the guys that I used to read about, the ones that are still left from a long time ago. I had the honor to go up to Plattsburgh, New York this past spring and present Mr. Paul Grimshaw with his inductee plaque to the NTA Hall of Fame. And, you know, I remember reading stories about E.J. Daly and the Adirondacks and those guys many, many years ago. And my first trapping lure, I ordered it, was an E.J. Daly lure. And it was a mink lure, and I slept in the bedroom with my two brothers, and every night I'd open that jar of mink lure and smell that lure, and my brothers hated me for it. But, you know, providing that and providing the protection that we provide, we have our regional conventions in the different regions, and, you know, in my mind, they have a huge value. I don't know how many times that I've been able at those regional conventions to talk to the general public because of that regional being there and explain to them a little bit more about what we do. And in a day and time where lawsuits and litigations are prominent and prevalent, it can be very beneficial to us when we leave a town and we leave that town with money in their pocket from our people that came here, and they understand that we're not a bunch of backwoods hillbillies, that we actually are organized organization, and we run things in a professional way, and the image that we leave with them can be invaluable when those things come down the pike, especially these ballot initiatives, which is all won, you know, by public opinion.
Right. Do you know how many people's been through the gate here already?
I can't tell
from the booth because it's so spread out, but it looks like it's a pretty good crowd.
I feel it has the feeling of being a good turnout. Earlier in the week, because we're so close to the river and the water, the rain they'd had earlier, we were a little bit concerned about that, but the humidity's dropped and the sun's out, and it's turned out to be a really good convention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and next year it's in Escanaba.
It is. I look forward to going back to Escanaba. That's probably the friendliest town I've ever been to. I've never been made feel more welcome. I mean, everywhere we went in that town, we went up to a laundromat there to do some laundry one evening there, and it was just amazing the people that came up to us because they knew we were trappers and talked to us and expressed their appreciation that we were there in their town.
Well, the cool thing about the UP is trapping's part of that culture. Even if they don't do it anymore, I mean, they know my granddad did it, my dad did it, you know, my brother-in-law does it, and I could tell that, and I know what you mean. It was, for what I tell you, it was weird to me, because you would see the ocean, but there was no salt smell there. That was a little freaky for me at first, but it was.
You know, if you've never been to an NTA convention, I strongly encourage you to come. I met a man today that's actually from up near Kingsport, Tennessee. He said he's never set a trap in his life.
And he's here.
He's here. He's been coming to conventions now for about the last 10 years. And he said he has always wanted to trap. And when he was a young man, he said, I'm going to start trapping when I retire. Well, he retired a few years ago, and life happens to you, and he hasn't been able to, but he believes in and supports what we do and enjoys coming to the conventions. There's a couple here from Kansas, the Simpsons, and they're at almost every convention that we have. They're big supporters. They donate their time and money around at these conventions, and he hasn't trapped since he was a young man. But that's pretty neat. You know, that's last night at our banquet, I witnessed one of the most unselfish things I've ever seen. Chris Richardson received the Environmentalist of the Year award. He was very proud of that, him being our Tennessee guy. Clarence Dyes, he had given Clarence a piece of walnut wood that his dad cut in 1960. Clarence built him and his dad both a turkey call out of it, and he had the rest of that lumber left, and he built another one to donate to the association for the auction last night. And we had two members, and I don't think they'd mind me mentioning their name, Don Powell and Ken Stewart, were bidding on that turkey call, and Chris was bidding on it too, but it kind of got a little bit more than he wanted to pay, and it kept going up, and when the bid was over, they took it over and gave it to Chris. You know, and that's total strangers. They have never met before in their life, and that's the kind of generosity and camaraderie you see at these conventions.
Well, the thing about the Nationals, it's the same for the FTA, but there's because there's crossover, but there's there's not as much as I wish there was. But there, because you know, some guys are more just do the FTA or the NTA thing, but. Over the years of doing this, every year, I may only get to talk to somebody for like 2 or 3 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
But after you do that for 15 years in a row, I mean, it's kind of like you're almost expecting them to show up at any minute. And they don't, you notice it.
Right.
You know, and we talk to a lot of people.
And, right.
And a lot of the stories that you learn from people that you would have never met any other way. You know, because you just go to state shows. I mean, there's guys I've became good friends with Canadians and, you know, and that to me, that's the neat thing about the NTA.
Well, you know, and the NTA and trapping as a whole, I remember when I started trapping when I was 13 years old, some of my family members, you know, questioned why I did it. You know, why do you want to do that? You know, why do you want to get out? You're not going to make any money doing it. You know, why are you doing it? Put your time into something else. The dividends the trapping has paid to me, and not in a monetary sense, far outweigh any lifetime earnings I could have ever received.
Oh, totally, yeah.
The things I've experienced, the people I've met across the United States, I tell you, it's just something that you can't put a price tag on.
This is true. Was there anything else we need to cover, do you think?
Nothing that I really can think of. I appreciate you having me on the show. I've always respected your business savvy and the fact that you, I remember when you got started, and I remember where you came from and where you've gone to, and I've always respected you for that. And
you definitely remember. It wasn't much.
And I appreciate you having given this opportunity, and I appreciate you letting Chip interview me for the NTA last year.
Cool. Well, I appreciate it, man. And pucker up.